What's up, people? It's that time again. WGN, let's join the two friends. Jason Whiteside and Rich Lenkoff in a legal face-off. Hear the knowledge they got. Legal point and counterpoint, Jay, you know the drill. From sports to Hollywood and the politics world. Not forgetting current events that occur. Plus a couple jabs here and there. Yeah. Airman, listen on WGNplus.com. Airman, listen on WGNplus.com. And join the conversation on Facebook and Twitter. Or send us an email with questions, we hear ya. Yeah, one love, you know. The lawyer's in the house.
Welcome in, Illegal Face-Off, WGN Plus. The Legal Eagles are here. They have settled into the studios at the Tribune Tower. Rich Lenkoff, Jason Whiteside. My name is Sam Panionovic. Plenty to get to today. We'll talk food trucks. We'll talk about off-duty police officers. We'll also go through the legal grab bag. We have an in-studio guest as well, but we start on the phone with Baylen Linekin, who's a food lawyer and adjunct professor at George Mason University Law School, and Austin Berg, who writes for the Illinois Policy Institute. Thank you both for joining us here on WGN.
Thanks for having me.
Hey, guys. Thanks. Austin, wanted to talk about your article recently in the Chicago Tribune about food trucks. In Chicago, this has been a hot issue off and on for a few years, ever since the Chicago City Council in 2012 came up with an ordinance dealing with where and when food trucks can operate in Chicago. So to start off, can you give us a really brief summary of why food trucks are or what the regulations are in Chicago right now for food trucks?
Absolutely. So you're right. In 2012, they passed this ordinance, and that's really where all these problems that they're having right now come down to. And in 2012, food truck owners said these two rules that you're putting in, one of them being the 200-foot restriction. You can't be within 200 foot of any brick-and-mortar restaurant. That includes, you know, the nicest steakhouse and also a 7-Eleven are both considered restaurants. You can't be within 200 feet of those. And you cannot stay parked in one spot for more than 2 hours. And at the time, Alderman basically said, oh, well, this is a living, breathing document. We'll fix this eventually. What happened was, though, that the city just didn't even enforce the two-hour rule, especially for the last 4 years. But only in the last 3 weeks have they started cracking down on that, and we're seeing really, really serious consequences for a lot of the trucks.
Yeah, why in the last 3 weeks has this been enforced, do you think?
This is due to a Sun-Times expose, which called these food truck owners basically scallywags and scofflaws, saying they're totally disregarding these traffic violations, these traffic rules in Chicago. It did not mention at all, though, the reason why these food trucks are piled on top of each other are, one, these ridiculous restrictions where they only have a handful of places that they can park in the loop. And food trucks have doubled since the industry started in Chicago, but these stands have been left the same. So there's so much demand for food trucks, but the city has not updated the ordinance to reflect that.
Yeah, why does the city of Chicago have so much hate for these food trucks? Because, I mean, Rich and I both travel. I mean, there's tons of other cities like New York, D.C. I mean, they have food trucks everywhere, and they're, you know, it's good food. I haven't gotten sick from any of them. But why does Chicago have such restrictions on them? And they seem like they're so far behind the times.
That's a great question. I mean, it's true. And you see this in all sorts of things in Chicago with new popular innovations, right? You see it with Uber, you see it with Airbnb, you saw it this week with driverless vehicles. And it comes down to old established special interests fighting against new innovative products that people like. In this case, that would go down to brick and mortar restaurants, Alderman trying to protect those. And we would like to see this two-hour restriction totally lifted. We would like to see more food truck stands in downtown Chicago. And perhaps the most ridiculous part of this is the city's hitting these food trucks with $1,000 to $2,000 tickets for this two-hour rule violation. And yet, four of their own food truck stands are totally inoperable because they're either due to construction or bad signage. So the city can't even follow its own rules, yet it's putting out city employees to harass these food trucks every day over staying in a place for 2 hours.
Baylen Linekin, you're, in addition to adjunct law professor at George Mason University Law School, you're one of the foremost food law and policy experts. You're an author. You wrote a book called Biting the Hands That Feed Us, How Fewer Smarter Laws Would Make Our Food System More Sustainable. Do you think that the Chicago ordinance dealing with food trucks is fair? Is it right? Is it constitutional? How do you feel about that?
I would call it unfair, not right, and unconstitutional.
Tell us why.
it's an absolutely terrible law that is one of the worst in the country. It's unfair. It baldly favors brick and mortar restaurants over food trucks. I think the law should favor neither, and that's always best for consumers. It's unconstitutional because it. There's an on point Illinois State Supreme Court case from the '60s that dealt with the ability of someone to open up a gas station within a particular distance of an existing gas station, and the state Supreme Court said, effectively, that the existence of a gas station in one corner has no bearing on whether another gas station should be able to go in, as long as those concerns of the state have nothing to do with health, safety, and welfare, typical sort of 10th Amendment concerns, then this is just protectionism, and that's never a legitimate justification to try to keep out new businesses.
So you feel like these businesses should operate on their own? They should avail themselves of sort of the free market, and, less government regulations should be imposed. And correct me if I'm not stating your position correctly. And if they fail because people don't want to eat their food because they feel that they're, it's unsafe or whatever, then they'll fail on their own. Is that sort of what you're saying?
Yeah, sure. Everyone should be treated equally. Inspections make sense for brick and mortar restaurants. They make sense for food trucks. And there's a good body of research that shows actually that the food served at food trucks, and there's a study from several major cities across the country, that food trucks are inspected more than brick and mortar restaurants, and their food is at least as safe, if not safer, than brick and mortar restaurants. I think in every city except Seattle, where they shook out as roughly equal.
Does the food truck industry just need better lobbying? I mean, Balin and Austin, is that what it is? Is that the restaurant industry has such strong lobbying, especially in Chicago, and food trucks just don't have the manpower yet?
I think they're certainly the little guy in this fight, just on a numbers basis. There's less than 100 food trucks in Chicago, and you obviously have thousands of restaurants. And I also love this issue of safety keeps coming up to justify these really burdensome restrictions. But the fact is, something like the two-hour rule, I've been talking to food truck owners this whole week, the ones who choose to risk getting a ticket and coming downtown in the first place. They say this makes their business far less safe because you've got to get to your parking spot. The clock is ticking. You need to heat up all your oil, your ovens. That can take up to 45 minutes to an hour for a business. And you have to, before you leave, obviously, you need them to cool down before you start driving with, burning hot oil in the back of your truck. So you're putting a lot of these, with this two-hour rule, you're putting a lot of these food truck operators in a sticky situation because they say either I can wait for my oil to cool down or risk losing my entire revenue for the day and get the heck out of here. That is a really toxic mixture, and I really hope the city changes this law before something bad happens.
Guys, I actually represent many brick-and-mortar restaurants. I haven't, dealt with this issue legally, but to play devil's advocate and to give, them some equal air, so to speak, according to the Illinois Restaurant Association's website, the question is, where is the Illinois Restaurant Association's stance on food trucks? And they say, they're pleased to work with both the mayor's office and Chicago's aldermen to ensure that all parties' best interests were represented in the current ordinance. And then, they talk very vaguely about wanting to support opportunities for small business owners and entrepreneurs to enter the food industry in a way that supports Chicago's world-class culinary offerings, is safe for consumers, and so forth and so on. Does that mean anything to you? Do you think they're really coming up with that?
No.
I mean, I'll be honest. I mean, I do represent a lot of restaurants, and I support them. I'm struggling, though, to find the counter to this argument. I'm struggling to find out why, aside from just strong lobbying, as Jason references, why there are these restrictions. I mean, how could you really operate a food truck and only be there for 2 hours? It seems, really hard to put together.
Guys, the Illinois restaurant, and I don't mean to denigrate the association that represents some of your clients, but that basically encapsulates the entire problem of this issue, which is the Illinois Restaurant Association saying, hey, we worked with restaurants and lawmakers to come up with great legislation for food trucks. Well, you know what? Food trucks weren't actually included in that. And it's the food trucks are being regulated. So if you have lawmakers and a restaurant association coming up with rules to govern someone else's business, I'm sure that the restaurant association wouldn't be too excited if the food trucks and lawmakers came up with rules to govern the the brick and mortar restaurants in the city. That's just sort of unfair and almost openly protectionist.
Well, tell you what, we're going to reach out to the Illinois Restaurant Association, invite them on next time to get their perspective. But we certainly appreciate you both coming on and sharing your feelings on the current status of the food truck ordinance here in Chicago.
Thank you.
That's Austin Berg from the Illinois Policy Institute and Baylen Linekin, who's a lawyer and adjunct professor at George Mason University Law School. The website, too, foodfightchicago.com. Thank you both for joining us.
The following information is considered advertising material. You're listening to Rich Lenkoff on Legal Face-Off. Rich is a partner at Bryce Downey & Lenkoff and handles workers' compensation, general liability, and entertainment law. He has been selected to the 2012 Illinois Super Lawyer List and has been named leading lawyer from 2012 through 2016. Rich has been honored as one of the 50 most influential people in workers' compensation by SEAK Incorporated and is a frequent lecturer for many national organizations. Bryce Downey & Lenkoff is a full-service law firm in Illinois and Indiana. Their clients enjoy a hand-picked team of attorneys supported by a world-class staff. Among their other practice areas are business litigation, construction, employment law, insurance coverage, intellectual property, and professional liability. To contact Rich and to learn more about Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, visit bdlfirm.com/WGN.
Legal Face-Off, WGN Plus, the Legal Eagles, Rich Lenkoff and Jason Whiteside. We go back to the phones now. There was a story in DNA Info written by David Matthews. The title is Police Should Wear Their Uniforms While Working Off-Duty. And to talk more about this, we welcome in an alderman from Chicago, a Democratic alderman from the 2nd Ward. He is Brian Hopkins, and he joins us now on WGN Plus. Hello, Alderman.
Guys, thanks for having me.
Alderman, thanks for joining us. The 2nd Ward includes some pretty prominent areas in Chicago, many of which have been in the news lately for some crime and violence that has gotten worldwide attention. Your ward includes areas like Streeterville, which is right in the heart of Michigan Avenue, Old Town, Lincoln Park, Ukrainian Village, Wicker Park, Bucktown, and the Gold Coast. So really areas where there's been some examples of crime lately. So tell us what your ordinance is that you're co-sponsoring with a couple other of your colleagues, what it is and why you think it's important.
Yeah, first of all, as Alderman representing a relatively diverse area, as you mentioned, which includes a number of different neighborhoods, the one uniform cry that I hear from every neighborhood I represent is the need for more police. We really believe that in the 2nd Ward, we don't have enough police officers to meet the demands for service we currently have. So we look for creative ways to supplement that. I've been having this conversation months prior to the mayor with his recent announcement that he's going to add more Chicago police. So that's a good thing. But we're also looking for ways to supplement and go over and above the current established patrol force. And this is one way to do it. We currently have a number of contracts in place with private security patrols. And these are state-licensed agencies that meet all the requirements. And many of them, in addition to hiring security guards who are not law enforcement, they also hire Chicago police officers who are willing to work on their days off for a little extra money. And we think there's a very real distinction between those two types of employees of private security firms, and the ones that are trained law enforcement officers should have the ability to wear their regular uniform when they're working off duty for a security firm.
So that is contrary to the current Chicago Police Department regulations, which currently forbid officers from wearing their uniforms on their second jobs unless they have approval from Police Superintendent Eddie Johnson. The idea being, or the reason behind the policy being, that the practice would not only confuse the public, but open up the police department to even more liability. And of course, you know, in the news as recently as today and this week, we've all heard about some recent police shootings in some other areas. So what do you say to the pushback that this would only open up the police department to potential liability when people, when their officers are off duty?
Well, that's a valid point. There's actually two elements to your question. Let me address the liability part of it second. First, I want to focus on the role of an off-duty police officer who might happen to be working part-time, during their day off. There currently is already in law an exception to that prohibition for them wearing their uniforms when they're off duty. What I'm seeking to do is expand that existing exception. And the exception's important. It allows an off-duty cop who is working for a private security firm that has a contract with either McPier, Navy Pier, or McCormick Place, when they're working security at Navy Pier or at McCormick Place, they can wear their CPD uniform if they are, in fact, off-duty Chicago police. And the logic behind that is ultimately they're being paid by a government agency, even though they're working for a private security firm. That firm has a contract with McPier, which is a quasi-governmental agency. There is the additional paycheck for the officers, so they're still being paid public money. They're still within the municipal corporate limits of the city of Chicago. They're an off-duty police officer, but they take an oath to serve and protect, and that oath is 24/7. It doesn't stop when they're not on duty. So there they are with a gun working security. Why not let them wear their CPD uniform? And it makes sense. So I'm expanding that to what we call SSA, special service areas, that are public tax bodies that include a very limited area. In the case of the Second Ward, it includes Old Town along Well Street, and there's another one in the Bucktown and Wicker Park area. And the same logic that applies to McPier would apply in those instances where they have a contract with a private security firm that uses off-duty Chicago cops.
You know, the article points out that there's a couple of more affluent neighborhoods in the city of Chicago that are already hiring their officers from suburban and Cook County departments to patrol the area. They did it especially in the summer. It says one man actually paid $50,000 for a security service. In those instances, has there been any reports of, I don't know how you want to term it, wrongdoing or, you know, acts that are committed by these off-duty cops where, you know, they might become egregious or, you know, violent beyond what the job requires?
No, we have had no reports of that. That's not to say the potential doesn't exist, and that goes to your second question about liability. You know, we've seen in recent years off-duty Chicago police officers behaving in an egregious manner. The infamous Abadi case comes to mind, and there's others more recently. So the liability that accrues to the city does not necessarily just go away when an officer ends their shift. And if someone wants to make a complaint, they might want to challenge whether or not that officer was acting in the course of their duties, even though they were off duty. And that would be something that would wind up before a trier of fact on a case-by-case basis. You know, there's really no way for us to escape that or to indemnify it. Although I will say in my ordinance, I specifically put in there some indemnifying language, and I also put in there a requirement that the state-certified security firms in question that would be hiring off-duty cops have to have double the amount of state-required liability insurance, and that would be mandatory for any of them to be able to wear their uniforms. And, of course, the city on our side, we enjoy tort immunity, so if there's going to be, a lawsuit based on some off-duty officer's behavior, we think that they would look first at the private security firm that was employing them before they would try to make a case against the city.
Alderman, I have a two-part question. Number one, has the police department or any of the rank-and-file police officers that you've talked to, have they had any response? Number one. Number two is, has there been any studies about the efficiency of police working off duty, wearing a uniform versus not wearing a uniform? In other words, is it more likely to reduce crime if people, see police officers wearing their uniform than simply having them out of uniform? So I know that's a lot of stuff in one question, but the first question was, what's the police response, if any, been so far?
Yeah, well, intuitively, you would think that having more uniformed police, even if they're off duty out there, would be a visual deterrent just based on the fact that, you know, if you see a cop walking down Well Street and you're thinking about snatching a purse, maybe you're not going to do it. So there must be some type of deterrent effect, even though I'm not really aware of any specific studies that would conclude that. The police officers I've talked to really fall into two camps. There's those who just think, you know, working part-time for a security firm isn't necessarily something that appeals to them. We all know, based on the debate at the City Council Budget Committee the past couple of years, we're spending over $100 million right now every year on police overtime. If a cop wants to make a little extra money over and above their regular 40-hour-a-week paycheck, they can do that without going to work for a private security firm. But there are those who still want to do that part-time to supplement their income. You know, they tend to be the younger officers with just maybe a few years on the force. You know, maybe they're just looking to start families and and buy their first house, and they need a little extra money, so they're willing to work 7 days a week, you know, in order to pull this off. I can tell you that the private security firms that have good reputations and that want to hire off-duty Chicago police officers have a demand that far exceeds the supply of willing officers who are able to work an extra day or an extra, you know, weekend or whatever when, you know, they could be home resting or could be home with their family. So not a whole lot of cops are really taking advantage of this now. But out of the ones that do, you know, we think it's a good thing. The voters tell me time and time again they want to see more cops on the street, and this is one way to do it in a way that doesn't fall directly on the taxpayers.
Alderman Hopkins, we'll get you out of here with one last question. To the point of adding more police officers to the street, you referenced the mayor's announcement yesterday, just yesterday, that after years of insisting that the Chicago police could make do without adding more officers, our mayor, Rahm Emanuel, announced yesterday that the department needed to add hundreds more to combat the violence that's plaguing our city. They announced a plan to hire nearly 1,000 officers, detectives, and supervisors over the next 2 years. Now, I realize that you and your colleagues in the city council probably haven't had a lot of time to absorb this because it was just announced yesterday, but I guess the question is, where's the money going to come from to pay for this? The mayor said that, you know, we'll find the money, that it's far more expensive to continue the violence that has, you know, invaded our city. But any sense of where the city's going to come up with this money given the financial state that we're in right now?
Not yet. I know the budget staff is working furiously on that, even as we speak right now. Probably they're still crunching the numbers, but it is an interesting role reversal. Typically, you have aldermen proposing solutions that don't necessarily have a means to pay for them. Now we've got the mayor doing it, so that's kind of an interesting turnabout. But he hasn't released his proposed budget for 2017 yet. The staff is still preparing that. I'm quite confident that they're going to have some type of revenue program that'll be a part of it. What it is, we don't know. I haven't even heard a rumor yet what it's going to be. But there will be a substantial price tag. We have to figure out how to pay for this. But I really think the case for doing it is absolutely rock solid. You know, we have an increase in a wide variety of crimes, not just the horrific gun violence that we're seeing in some neighborhoods, but quality of life crimes, the more petty street crimes, and armed robbery. Some of these are up over 70% in some areas. And the clearance rate for crimes is going down because our detectives are overworked. They're short-staffed. They have a greater caseload. They're unable to solve crimes. 911 response times are up. There's just all sorts of indications that the productivity of the police officers that we have now has fallen due to the fact that there just aren't enough of them, and the ones that are there are overworked. Well, I can't think of any other way to solve that problem except hiring more cops. So the real challenge is going to be figuring out how to pay for it.
That's Alderman Brian Hopkins from Chicago's 2nd Ward. It's fascinating stuff. We will keep our eyes peeled, and we'll look for more breaking news in the coming weeks. Thank you so much for joining us here on WGN Plus.
Thanks, guys.
Whiteside & Goldberg Limited is a law firm that specializes in representing injured people in all types of accidents. Whether it be an auto accident, a workplace accident, medical malpractice, construction accident, or slip and fall, the attorneys at Whiteside & Goldberg have a combined 30-plus years of legal experience to represent you. We offer a free consultation and have 2 offices to serve you throughout the Chicagoland area. If you or someone you know have been injured and you have questions regarding your rights, feel free to contact the law firm of Whiteside & Goldberg today for a free consultation. You can call us at 312-334-6875. And for more information, visit our website at wglawgroup.com.
Welcome back to Legal Face-Off on WGN Plus. Make sure to check us out on iTunes, Facebook, and Twitter. You can always share with a friend, always review. We welcome in studio from the Northern Illinois University College of Law, he's Professor Michael Oswalt, and he joins us here in the Tribune Tower on WGN. Thanks for coming in.
Oh, it's great to be here.
Professor, thanks for joining us. We wanted to talk about your recent article in the Huffington Post about improvisation at work and the Fight for 15 movement. Can you tell us what prompted you to write the article in the first place?
Well, it's a really neat recent evolution within the labor movement. It's a specific aspect of it that's tried to increase the minimum wage to $15 an hour nationally and also for union rights. And it started out in November 2012 when 200 fast food workers walked off the job for a day. And those strikes, those actions have continued basically every 4 to 5 months. But they've also been expanding. The most recent one was in the spring, around 100 U.S. cities, including Chicago, and 60 countries. But what interests me about it is much of its pretty amazing successes. I think it's fair to say, from the perspective of 2012, $15 an hour minimum wage was really seen as almost laughable, even essentially an aspirational demand. But it's now seen as a litmus test for politicians. It's part of the Democratic Party platform, and New York and California just legislated it into life.
So your article talks about the fact that a lot of this was, you know, improvised in some respects. Is that unusual in the labor movement as far as these things go in history with some historical perspective?
It is certainly in the recent history. One of the ways I like to think about it is, you know, what do you do if you're a movement that used to represent one out of every three workers in the private sector, which is pretty unbelievable. If we go back to the 50s and 60s, one out of every three workers was a union member. And now that number's under seven.
Wow.
And you improvise. And, you know, when I use that term, it means essentially what you think it means, which is all the stuff that goes on in Old Town on a Friday night at Second City. You know, it's taking facts, ideas, situations as they arise, and then building on them, accepting them, no matter how bizarre they are, building on them into something new. And something new, I think, is what we see in this campaign.
So now you said that, New York and California have already adopted the $15 minimum wage?
Well, they're on a path to do so.
Just like Chicago, right? Chicago has, I know Chicago is getting there, I think to 13 by 2019.
That's right. That's exactly
19
right.
Or 17, right?
Yep.
Have they? What's the minimum wage like in those, I'd pick any cities, I guess, in California, New York. Have the wage increases affected, I know the argument against the wage increase is that it's going to decline business, it's going to, you know, cause businesses to close down. Have there been any studies published with the effect on that increase in minimum wage?
So there hasn't been much. The best sort of real-time data we have on that, because it's a very good question, in particular given that the federal level is $7.25, I'd say the best data right now is out of Seattle, which has kind of been on the vanguard of this movement. They're up to $13 already. They passed a $15 an hour minimum in 2013. And just in July, the University of Washington published a study kind of looking at potential price increases and also hiring. And interestingly enough, they found pretty much no change on both of those accounts. They did note that low-wage workers had more money to spend. The caveat with that, I'll say, is that Seattle right now is booming, and so arguably they've been able to handle any increases. But there's a lot of other examples out there where a significantly higher minimum wage has worked.
Yeah, I mean, it's tough because even at a minimum wage of whatever, what's Chicago right now, $8.25 or $8.75?
Actually, Chicago's a little over $10 now.
Is it?
Yeah. Illinois is $8.25.
Probably still not enough.
No, I mean, that's my point. I think at $10, I don't know how that's a livable wage. I mean, it's a pretty low, at $40 a week, you know, it's $400 a week gross, which doesn't, but I mean, does 13, a jump to 13 or 15, does that give even enough a livable wage, or what do they call it, a living wage, whatever
living
it is,
wage.
To those people that are earning that?
Well, it's a great question. Even at $15, if you're working full-time, that brings you up probably to around 30. The poverty rate for a family of four is around 28,000. So it's going to bring you up just about that level, assuming you can get full-time work. I mean, you know, that's certainly another important aspect of this issue.
Professor Oswald, you teach a variety of subjects at the Northern Illinois University College of Law, torts, employment law, workers' compensation, also labor law, of course, which is what we're talking about today. What is the current business response to the fight for 15, and how do you feel about that? I mean, a lot of, you know, businesses are pushing back. Here locally, a lot of different lobbyists and associations have pushed back on the fight for 15, arguing that it will have a negative effect on businesses. What's your feeling on that?
Well, I mean, certainly you hear arguments about job loss, price increases, sometimes the specter of robots coming in and taking over people's job. You know, I think the reality is a minimum wage increase that large to some extent is an experiment, right? I mean, this is something that economists argue about and are going to continue to argue about. You know, there are examples in the U.S. where they've had increases and, you know, the problems have been minimal. In-N-Out Burger, famously, you know, a lot of this campaign is focused on fast food, has long paid their workers over $11 an hour with a full package of benefits. You know, those are cheap burgers that people still like. If the minimum wage itself had kept pace with inflation, we'd actually be to about $18 an hour right now. But my overall response to that is, in many ways, what Fight for 15 is telling us, what the campaign is saying, is that at least $15 is what low-wage workers are telling us they need to live, right, that they need to function. And at the very least, that should be an important piece of information as policy is set going forward. And if some cities want to experiment with going right up to $15 right now, that probably makes sense.
Is there any sort of a psychological benefit for these workers, too, if they do get that $15? I mean, are they going to be happier, more productive, you know, members of the business, and you're going to see an increase in productivity there? I mean, is there any evidence towards that at all, Professor?
Yeah, there's some studies which suggest, some actually famous studies that go back even to the 70s and 80s, that wage increases can increase things like longevity. You kind of raise another point, which is that you know, there are some things potentially to the public detriment that are associated with low wages, right? There's a study that suggests there's actually about a $7 billion subsidy going nationally to fast food companies because if their workers aren't paid enough, you know, they end up on public benefits.
Professor, we've covered on this show a lot the sharing economy, Uber, Airbnb, things like that. We've all also covered movements by workers like, you know, the Uber workers, their attempts to collectively bargain, their attempts to get benefits. Do you think in the modern economy we'll see more improvisation with these labor movements? Do you think that improvisation is something that lends itself to the sharing economy?
I do, because improvisation is fundamentally about experimenting. It's fundamentally about taking ideas that haven't been tried before and giving them a shot. And I think we're seeing that right now with Uber drivers. There have been some experimenting, actually, believe it or not, with Uber strikes. We're seeing some very traditional unions try and form Uber associations and do kind of a meet and confer model with Uber. And then we're also seeing a number of the new on-demand companies actually adopting a traditional employee model, which is very different from what Uber does. And I think that goes to an earlier point that some companies are realizing actually more stability in their workforce can create a better workforce.
Professor Oswald, about a minute left here on Legal Face-Off. We'll get you out of here with this last question. You've got a pretty impressive biography prior to Northern Illinois, including clerking for, at the time, Judge, now Justice Sonia Sotomayor. My question to you is, did you have any sense back when you were clerking for her when she was on the Second Circuit Court of Appeals that she maybe, you know, had a chance to be on the highest court in the land? Any sense back then of what her future might hold?
I didn't have any direct sense. I just knew that she was an absolutely incredible woman and would be perfect for the Supreme Court if the opportunity ever came. And I think we're seeing that.
He lied. I have a question. Did you ever see J.J. Redick play Cameron Indoor?
You know, I did.
Oh, that
I saw him beat UNC.
He didn't miss from like 30 feet. Now, that's got to be a great place to watch college games.
Oh, it's incredible.
Were you a Cameron crazy? I think I recognize you,
you know,
from
as a
blue paint on your face.
As a grad student, I probably didn't quite reach that level, but I made my face known to the extent I could, yeah.
That is Professor Michael Oswald, Assistant Professor of Law at NIU College of Law. Thanks for coming downtown.
Oh, thank you. This was great.
It's time for the Legal Grab Bag on Legal Face-Off, WGN Plus, with Rich and Jason. We've got 9 topics today, and lots of J's, not a lot of R's, so you're going to be taking the lead on a lot of these.
It's like, I got it today, huh?
Yeah, you're going to
climb on my shoulders
in the grab bag.
I'm just going to sit back and watch.
And eat that healthy salad.
Let's start with the exploding phone lawsuit all around Samsung. Samsung actually confirmed the other day that exploding phones were reported in China. What is an exploding phone and why is it important?
You know, Samsung issued a recall on their phone, but they didn't follow the exact procedures on it, and they had a battery issue where it would overheat and explode. So there's a couple of people that sustained some pretty serious injuries. You know, as a plaintiff's attorney, this is kind of a layup. I mean, there was a known defect with the phone. Instead of going to Consumer Reports and issuing the a general recall, they issued a recall to some of the people that they could get a hold of. I mean, Samsung's defense is that we couldn't reach everyone because some people don't buy the phone directly through us. But anyway, there's going to be numerous lawsuits that pop up because of this, because it's a known defect that Samsung put out in the marketplace.
Do you have one yet? Have you jumped in on that?
I'm hoping after the show today that perhaps I get one or two.
Call 1-800-EXPLODING-PHONE for
exploding
Jason Whiteside.
Pants or any legal representation. But seriously, I mean, it's a very plausible case in the sense that they knew about the issue. There was a defect with the phone. They didn't timely put out notice to prevent some of these injuries that happened. There's one other case where a guy was charging in a hotel room and it burned the hotel room and cost about $1,400 worth of damage. So there's a lot of damage that can apparently take place from an exploding
phone. So lithium batteries, right? The same thing that was exploding the hoverboards.
Yeah, the same thing. It just, for some reason, it reacts poorly to the charge. So
not a great day for Samsung. I mean, I represent a lot of big corporations, and this stuff, more than just the cost of settling or trying the case, you know, the damage or potential damage to the brand is huge.
We usually see interesting headlines with Donald Trump.
Speaking
Republican
of brands, right?
Nomination, Republican candidate. This is one that I didn't even think I'd ever see. Trump uses charity to settle lawsuits.
Yeah, you know, this week, you know, another week, another Trump legal story. In addition to the hundreds of contractors that he allegedly has stiffed by not paying, and those people have sued him. The latest lawsuit, or the latest legal news, is that Trump allegedly, according to this Washington Post story that was published this week, on four occasions, the Donald J. Trump Foundation cut checks to settle suits, which is against the law. I mean, you know, ethically wrong, but actually against the law. So if he is using his charities to settle lawsuits that derive from his business endeavors, that's not good. Now, he says that it involves the charity, so it's okay, but it doesn't really matter. You can't take money that people are giving you for charitable causes and use it to settle lawsuits.
I mean, I think not to defend Donald Trump, but a couple of the lawsuits where he was – As part of the settlement, I mean, he didn't pay the plaintiff any money, but he would just make a donation to one of them was like a veterans group out of his charitable fund. So, I mean, I don't know. It skirts the ethical and legal issue, but maybe it still still holds water.
Actor Jim Carrey has been sued for wrongful death, for his ex-girlfriend, and he has since responded to these claims.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. The estranged husband, so we'll spell this out, the man who was married to Jim Carrey's girlfriend while Jim Carrey was dating her, is now filing a wrongful death lawsuit against Jim Carrey, since they were allegedly his pills that she used to commit suicide with. So they were under his pseudonym or a different name that he had given, and he says that it is totally legal to take them, to accept the prescriptions under the name of Arthur King, and that White got a hold of them without his knowledge. So that was that's going to be his defense to the lawsuit.
Yeah, and the basis of the complaint is that Jim Carrey should have known. I guess this woman had a history of trying to commit suicide. She had a history of depression. So the estranged ex-husband is alleging that Jim Carrey, by giving her these prescription medications, should have known, given her history, that she would have tried to kill herself. So it is a violation of California laws. It is in most states to use a pseudonym to obtain drugs, prescription drugs. So Jim Carrey, of course, came out categorically denying all of this. So that's another celebrity in the news.
Angelina Jolie, Brad Pitt, Splitsville, filed for divorce. Now, what happens to the six kids that they have? They might have some custody issues on the horizon.
Yeah, surprise? Anyone surprised by this?
No.
No, I'm surprised that it lasted this long.
Yeah, another Hollywood marriage.
I did find it funny, though, that Angelina Jolie was upset that Brad Pitt did something with a cast member, like a
coworker, right?
And that's what she did. That's why Jennifer Aniston.
Karma is a bitch.
She got Angelina. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, there's a million like memes out there of Jennifer Aniston just laughing at this whole thing. But, yeah, I mean, raises a couple legal issues. The most interesting thing that I saw was, which is unusual in these kind of cases, is that Angelina Jolie is asking the court to award joint legal custody, but she's asking for her to get sole
physical custody,
right? Parental custody, which is really unusual. I mean, basically, when you ask the court for one parent to give sole custody, what you're basically saying is the other parent is unfit and you don't want the kids.
There was an incident that happened that just came out. I mean, I read it this afternoon on the way over here. Supposedly, I mean, this comes from, OK or In Touch magazine or one of those, but that on Wednesday of last week, what triggered all this was they were on a private plane flying somewhere, and Angelina's alleging that Brad Pitt became very violent with one of the children and did something. As soon as they got off the plane, it was reported to the authorities, and so now California Department of Child and Family Services is investigating an alleged abuse by Brad Pitt against one of the children. So I don't know if that's the impetus for her to file the full custody against Brad, but I'm sure there's going to be a vigorous defense by Mr. Pitt.
Yeah, but I mean, there was that, and there was, allegations of a lot of marijuana use, which, listen, you're Brad Pitt. Is that really surprising?
I mean, I'm surprised that it's just marijuana.
Yeah, exactly. So. But, I mean, it is unusual to ask for sole physical custody and joint legal custody, because legal custody means you're able to participate in most of the major decisions involving the kids. Why would you do that if you're saying that the parent is not fit enough to be in physical contact with the children? So stay tuned. Lots of L.A. lawyers will make some great money off this case.
My favorite meme, by the way, was the one of Pitt saying, "Wait, you want all the kids?" And he's like, "All right,
wow,
yeah, all right."
How many days till we see him off on a beach with his next 20-year-old?
Him and Leonardo DiCaprio hanging out with supermodels.
That would be a twosome. JonBenet Ramsey was found dead in her family's home, 1996. It's been almost 20 years, yet the investigation is still drawing people. Former Colorado Governor Bill Owens weighed in. Why is this still in the news?
You know, there was an investigator that was part of the, I think it was a 60 Minutes expose, and once he retired from the FBI, he took over this investigation privately. They've been doing this for a very long time, and his conclusion came up with that the brother accidentally, I think they just revealed this on Monday night, that the brother accidentally killed her and in a fit of rage, and so the parents tried to cover it up, and he goes through this whole diatribe on how the note was just a rambling four-page note. It didn't make sense. It was like they were trying to pretend that it was a kidnapping, and it didn't really occur. So
yeah, it was actually there's this two-part CBS special. I've seen only a little bit of it, but there was a former FBI profiler and a Scotland Yard investigator who sort of led this look back at the investigation. My opinion, a lot of nonsense. I mean, to be honest, a lot of junk science, a lot of theories that have been thrown out in the past. For example, a big part of the conclusion that they came to in concluding that Burke did it, Burke is the brother, was this 911 tape. They enhanced the audio from the 911 tape when Patsy Ramsey thought that no one was listening. In fact, the 911 tape was still recording. They brought it to a sound engineer, made a big deal about enhancing it and finding these three other voices. And they say that these three other voices clearly say words that would incriminate the family. So a couple of things. When you listen to it, all you hear is basically Peanuts teachers, like wah, wah.
Yeah.
You can't hear anything.
Garbled.
And these investigators on the CBS special acted as if, oh, my God, we're hearing this for the first time. In fact, this has been known for about 15 years. These alleged words, incriminating words that the family used, were published like in 1999. So them acting on the show like they're hearing it for the first time shows how, I think, incredible the whole thing is. But
yeah. And also, too, I mean, if anyone watched the 5 minutes of Dr. Phil's interview with Burke, you kind of get the sense that this kid's a little creepy. I mean, it was a little I only watched a couple minutes of it, but it was seeing him smile the whole time, and he just acted like it was.
I mean, the kid definitely has some anxiety and interpersonal issues. But I mean, does that mean that he killed his sister because she stole his pineapple? That's the allegation, that because she had JonBenet was found with pineapple in her belly, he was mad and hit her over the head with a flashlight. I mean, it's a bunch of nonsense, in my opinion. Also, one last interesting thing is this was actually a real revelation in the last couple of weeks. The grand jury in Colorado in Boulder that heard this case back in 20 years ago, after 18 months of investigating the case, they actually returned an indictment against both parents, against both John and Patsy Ramsey. The prosecutor in Boulder decided not to proceed because he didn't think there was enough evidence. But I had never known that the grand jury actually returned an indictment. It wasn't for murder. It wasn't for manslaughter. It was against child abuse. But they actually concluded at the conclusion of the grand jury that there was enough evidence to proceed.
Indiana Tech School of Law. Their first bar class had 12 graduates. Guess how many passed the bar?
12?
One. 1 out of 12. That is 8% of the first graduating class at Indiana Tech Law School to pass the bar. Wow.
Yeah, I hate to pick on this school. They're new, you know, not a very well-known school. And you're right, only one of the 12 graduates who sat for the bar exam passed. So not a great result, obviously. The results were just announced September 12th. I think it sort of speaks to the bigger picture here, and what we've covered on this show in the past is, you know, does the world need more lawyers? Does the world need more law schools? This is a new law school. They're not yet ABA accredited, which is sort of the standard for most law schools. But, you know, I think it speaks to the idea that we need less people going to law school, not more.
Well, yeah, and I mean, law school admissions are on a decline. So, yeah, I don't know. When did Indiana Tech start up?
It's only a couple years old. I think it started in like
3 years ago. Is this the first graduating class? It'll be three
right,
years ago.
Exactly, yeah.
Oh, that's too bad.
So makes my bar passage rate feel a little better in comparison.
Emma Watson has demanded that a website remove her private photos. There's a lawsuit involving private pictures. We've seen this story before.
Yeah, Celeb Jihad, a tabloid website, came up with some photographs that were that showed a little bit too much of Emma Watson. She was braless in a sheer top, and then they published them on their website. So Emma Watson's lawyers sprung into action and just sent a cease and desist letter, which is simply saying stop, take down the photographs, stop publicizing them, otherwise we'll file a lawsuit against you. So they did, and the photographs were removed. So it was a rather quick, wasn't even a lawsuit, it was quick action by the legal team to rid the internet of those photos.
We got two more to go. We'll let you close it out. Ellen DeGeneres has been sued for defamation.
Yeah, Ellen DeGeneres had a what was a little bit funny, but not really.
A little bit.
She had a segment on her show where a real estate agent named Titty Pierce was brought on. She was a real estate agent. And
what did you just say? Can you say that? You know we're on the radio. Right? Can you say what you just said?
That's her name.
Do WGN standards and practices have
to
run in here?
It's pronounced TT.
Uh-huh. All right, go ahead.
So Ellen jokingly called her Titty. And now then also failed to blur out her cell phone number in the segment, which caused
probably worse, having the number.
Yeah,
on there, right.
I mean, well, that's what her real beef was about, was that during a funeral service, several people were calling her, pranking her with her cell phone number. So she was emotionally distressed and filed a lawsuit.
For the record, she says that her name is pronounced T T, and she said no one ever referred to her as the other word.
Can we not say that word?
You can, apparently.
Titty. There, I said it.
I'm just reading the news.
So am I. Last thing. Pebbles Reed is proceeding with a $40 million lawsuit. Is it against Viacom? Am I reading this right?
Do we know who Pebbles Reed is, by the way? It's
no,
the first
no
time
one has a
anyone's
clue
ever said the
who Pebbles Reed is.
Pebbles Reed.
I don't know where they dug this story out from. All I know is Pebbles Reed was associated with TLC, great group from the 90s.
Come on, don't go chasing waterfalls.
God rest the soul.
Or Watercock.
Can't find him.
Do not go chasing Watercock because he's MIA.
Who was it? Lisa Left Eye Lopez that died in the car
accident?
Yeah,
she's the most prominent member. Yep. She was my favorite.
She's the one that burned down Andre Rison's house, right, in the 90s.
Poor Andre Rison.
Took all his sneakers in the bathtub and lit those babies on fire.
Yeah.
But apparently there's a lawsuit that Pebbles Reed was not paid by Viacom appropriately. She's filing a lawsuit. Now TLC is getting involved.
$40 million in damages.
That's a lot of money.
Pebbles Reed seen $40 million in her whole,
Did TLC even earn $40 million?
Do you guys know anybody? I want to have a lawsuit. I want to start a lawsuit. I want $40 million.
Burn down Brian Watercott's home.
Go into his bathtub and burn it down.
Let's just spend the next 5 minutes on Watercott, by the way.
We're out of time. look at the clock.
You know, in reviewing this, though, I fell in love with all my favorite TLC songs all over again, though.
Yeah, there's Waterfalls, and then there's
Shoop. Shoop's a big one.
No, it's Shoop. I thought Shoop is...
That's not TLC.
Salt and Pepper.
No Scrubs.
No Scrubs.
No Scrubs.
Unpretty.
No, that's all Salt and Pepper, isn't it?
No, that's TLC.
No Scrubs is what is TLC?
Yes.
Wow.
I confused my mid-90s genre rap.
Maybe we'll get Pebbles Reed on the show next week. Yeah. Or next time.
All right. That about does it for Rich and Jason.
And Brian.
And Brian. And
Watercott.
And Michael. I'm Sam. Thanks for listening. Thanks to all of our guests. For anything you may have missed, WGNplus.com. Search for Legal Face-Off. We'll see you in 2 weeks.
The content of this broadcast has been prepared by Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, LLC, and Whiteside & Goldberg, Limited, for informational purposes. This information does not intend to create, and receipt of it does not constitute, a lawyer-client relationship. You should not act upon this information without seeking advice from a lawyer licensed in your own state. In considering prior results, please be aware that each matter is unique, and prior results are not necessarily representative of all matters of Bryce Downey & Lenkoff, LLC, and Whiteside & Goldberg, Limited. You should not rely on prior results to predict future success in similar matters. Please do not send or disclose to either firm confidential information or sensitive materials.